And it certainly seems like a good time to come to a Woodhaven in retreat. There's been so much that pulls us outward, this sort of tremendous centrifugal force going on. And so to do the countervailing move of coming inward really feels sweet to me, and I hope to you. As I was sitting, I had two images come up, and one of them is the one about the rainmaker, yeah? The old man who was asked to come to the village when it hadn't rained, and it hadn't rained, and it hadn't rained, and the people had tried absolutely every possible prayer and every move to get the rain to fall. And so there was desperation. And so the old man arrived on a train, I think, and they asked him what he needed, and he said, "Give me a little hut, you know, the side of the village, and bring me rice every day." And they did, and he was in there for days, like maybe 7 days or something, and they brought him rice, and the empty bowl appeared at the door, and then at the end of 7 days it rained, and he went to the train station to get on the train, and they said, "What did you do?" Right? And he said, "I didn't do anything. You know, the thing, I felt out of alignment with the Tao. So I stayed there until I felt in alignment with the Tao, and then it rained." And to me, this feels a little bit like that move for us, to come and be here and have a chance to bring ourselves into alignment with the Tao, which you can never leave anyway, but and yet we can accept the invitation to cooperate with the change. So a good time to turn inward and to hang out with a good story. And this story chose us for this time, oddly, and I don't know exactly why, but I have a couple thoughts about it. I thought I would tell you why I think maybe it wouldn't go away and wanted to come. And one reason was that it feels to me like a story about a journey towards a union and a freedom. The story does seem to me to be about awakening in some way. And because it's the time of this welling up of the feminine voice, not just women and girls, but the feminine, starting to have a voice in a world that I think can use a little bit of that voice. And so I'm kind of interested in this story that also seems to me to have to do with that. How does the feminine come to a place to be able to appear and be a creative presence. And also because this story to me carries a sense of sort of being worked over by the gods, you know, being helpless in the hands of the gods, but not helpless. And so that was another theme that was sort of calling to me, that Are they helping? is this helping? Like that kind of question to be hanging out. And then, of course, for me, because we're engaged in Heart Sutra studies, this story stuck out for me as a story that connects to the Heart Sutra in a peculiar and interesting way, to Heart Sutra as a journey, rather than as statement. And I felt a resonance there, something to do with embodiment and humanness and trusting life, at a moment when I will confess I'm not finding it that easy moment by moment to be trusting life. So how do I trust life? What do I trust? And that coming in. So how I'd like to proceed for this weekend. First of all, I'd like this, my aspiration for us, for this time for us, is that it should be a time of deep refreshment. So use it as you like this time. I think a time for renewal and rest and curiosity. Bring in what you'd like to bring in. We'll have break times a little bit and some time to be outside. And we're lucky. I think it's going to be beautiful weather. And we'll be moving in and out of meditation in a fairly fluid way. I didn't post a schedule. We will have lunch, I think, at 11:30 or something. Did they say what time we're having lunch?
Who's handed something?
Oh, 12:15. We'll have lunch at 12:15. And I think we'll give ourselves a good size break after lunch so that there will be time to do some journaling, some artwork if you want to wander around, to sleep. We've got couches and so I really would like there to be a leisurely feel for this. And time to find ourselves in the story. And time to invite dreamlike states. So, you know, really nap time, you know, and musing time. And also for the refreshment of deep listening, listening to ourselves, listening to the story, listening to each other, listening to this place, listening to the vastness itself. I will bring in a koan or more, and invite you to do so also, as koans, you know, wave their hands at you or wink at you. Bring them on in. The one that came to me really as a kind of felt like a talisman for this weekend is one that I actually brought to the intro class I started last night. And I have never done that before. You know, we had 22 people at various stages of things, some, you know, really that I'd never met before at all. But this koan just wanted to come, and it's the one that many of you know about Master Sho of Kokei. Yeah? Someone asked Master Sho, when things come at you from the four directions and the eight dimensions, what then? And Master Sho said, hit the middle. And the person bowed And he said, on my way to a service in the village, I ran into a wild storm of wind and rain and sheltered myself in an old shrine. So later someone asked, the self that show sheltered, does it exist prior to the empty kalpa, that endless age of immeasurable length that comes before anything at all? And the answer comes as a yes. This is the realm of the peaceful body. Creating life. So there's something, although, you know, that there's something about an old story. A place to shelter the self that exists before the empty kalpa. So let's have a walk, and then we'll sit for a little bit more, and then I'll tell you the story. He says, this is the realm, this is indeed the realm of the peaceful body establishing life. And that's an interesting word, isn't it? The peaceful body establishing life. A story. Begins, once there was a kingdom. And there is a kingdom. And it's interesting because, you know, this one has a long history of associations, and psyche means soul. And that kingdom, yeah. So we're in that kingdom, and where there's both the ordinary part of that kingdom, the sort of daily part, and the special unearthly inner part of the kingdom. And in this kingdom, we have Aphrodite, Venus, goddess of femininity, there from the beginning of all the gods and goddesses. Aphrodite, born from the sea. Cronus, son of Uranus, god of the sky, cuts off his father's genitals and throws them into the sea. And out of that fertilization, Aphrodite is born. And there she is with her oceanic power. She reigns in the unconscious, not very relatable, extremely powerful. And along comes Psyche, conceived by dewdrops that fell from the sky. A much softer beginning, huh? A little more relatable. And it was said of Aphrodite that her servant always, she had a servant who always carried a mirror in front of her so she could see herself. Quite an image of that, is that, huh? And so suppose maybe she's offering us a mirror, yeah? And to see ourselves and our projections. And what about that moment, falling in love, where a mirror is held up, where we see for a moment, the beauty of ourselves that we ordinarily don't see. And so along comes this young woman, Psyche, more beautiful than all, greeted by everyone or seen by everyone, not so much greeted. Yeah, as the new Aphrodite, the new model, newer and better. So we have then along the way the meeting of that softer power and the great oceanic power of Aphrodite, who would like everything to be the way it always was. And that sort of necessary conflict, we get the story of this necessary conflict. Aphrodite explodes with enormous energy, and her explosions make everyone around her grow. Robert Johnson tells a story about elephants that I had never encountered before. That elephants, a group of elephants were seen tossing a brand newborn baby around their circle. And this would be a bunch of mama elephants. And and at first it seemed kind of horrifying. Why are they throwing this newborn baby elephant around? And it was to make it breathe. The baby wasn't breathing until they did that. That's a pretty powerful image, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So here's Psyche, the most beautiful young woman that anybody could imagine, worshipped but not courted. Her two older sisters happily married to neighboring kingdoms, but Psyche is only worshipped. So in desperation, the king goes to the oracle. The version that I gave you says the oracle of Apollo, but apparently this was under Aphrodite's control. And the oracle says, she will be married to the ugliest, most awful monster. Got to take her to the top of the mountain and chain her to a rock. So, with tremendous grieving, and maybe also some hope, everyone prepared for the wedding as you prepare for a funeral. And apparently, rituals for weddings in traditional cultures often were based on rituals for funerals, because a marriage was seen also as a death. But in any case, this one was, and everyone prepared, trooped up to the top of the mountain, chained Psyche to the rock, and she was a very willing participant, because at that point anything was better than hanging out in the Crystal Palace where nobody could touch her and nobody would. And they extinguished their torches and left her there. Meanwhile, Eros, the bane of Olympus, who went around shooting his little arrows at everybody and causing all kinds of chaos and difficulty, nonetheless was under his mother Aphrodite's thumb. He pretty much had to do what mom told him. And she told him to go and inflame Psyche with love for the beast, for the horrible monster to whom she was going to be wed. So another thing that stands out about this story for me is the way something has to happen, right? So you can't just sort of leave Psyche there in the palace stuck, right? And so what propels her out of there is Aphrodite's jealousy. Aphrodite saying, no, I wanted to be the way it was. They're not, you know, it's just cold ashes in my temples. Nobody's going there. So she sends Eros off. But in the process of, dripping the appropriate potions on her, he catches a glimpse of her. And he also pricks his own finger with his arrow, yeah? And falls. And so he asks the west wind to gently bring her down to the valley of paradise. So lo and behold, in the morning, there she is in the green valley. And she finds that she has everything a person could dream of. A mansion, invisible servants, and a husband who comes to her in the night, such a lover, and who asks only that she not ask to know or see him. Your perfect, invisible lover, who himself really can't, he's in a pretty safe spot, isn't he? Nobody's going to ask too much of him when he's got himself protected from being seen. So Eris promises her that they will live happily ever after there, just don't ask to see him. He kind of would like to be free to forget about the marriage when he's off doing other stuff in another place. He'd like it to stay right there where it's pretty sweet. So, enter the two sisters. The two sisters who get wind of this arrangement that Psyche has, it sounds like better than theirs. And they come and appear at the top of the mountain. calling down, sis, how are you doing down there? How is it? We hear it's kind of sweet. And but we miss you so much. We've been so worried about you. And her loneliness is just unbearable at that point. She misses them so much. And so she begs, yeah. And Eros explains to her, you know, if you abide by this agreement, your child, our child, can be a god. Or, if you don't, could be a girl and a mortal. She agrees. And when she agrees, he says, okay then, not a good idea, but okay. And the West Wing brings her sisters gently down. And boy, do they have questions. Yeah? Who is this guy really? You know, what's really going on here? And she describes him out of her own fantasy. A handsome god who's out hunting during the day. And they go away, but they don't really buy it. And she gets lonely again and asks again and begs again. And they come again. And this time she comes up with a different fantasy story about him. And the same thing happens. They go away. And again she gets really lonely and begs again. And the third time they come, they say, you know what, honey? You're getting duped here. This is a serpent. A giant serpent. And when your baby is born, he's simply going to eat you both. Mom and baby both. And we're so worried about you. And we really just can't stand for this to happen to you. So here's what you got to do. You need to go in at night with bring in with you a lamp, hide it. And when he's well asleep, you're going to have your sharp knife as well. You're going to get a good look at him with your lamp, and you are going to slay him before he can kill you. So she's gotten pretty good and scared by now, and so she agrees to do what they've told her to. She carries in the lamp under a cover, the hidden lamp. Reminds you of anything we know? The Book of Koans? The hidden lamp?
Yeah.
She carries in the lamp, and when she uncovers it and looks at him, she realizes, oh, shit. I blew it. He's the god. He's the god of love, the most beautiful god there is, and I'm done for. I've completely blown it. I've been wrong. I've done wrong, and now I will kill myself. But she drops the knife. She bungles it, manages to prick herself on his arrow, and fall so deeply in love. And she spills a drop of oil, burning hot oil, on his shoulder. And he wakes in excruciating pain and takes flight. She tries to hang on. She hangs on to his foot and actually gets lifted up a bit and carried out of that magic place, and then she falls to earth. And he lands, and he lets her have it. He lets her know what she has done, and that she's destroyed their paradise. And he leaves. So once again, you know, things couldn't just stay there. It would be end of story, yeah? You see him at night, you wander around in the day, you miss your sisters. End of story? No. And so the sisters, those wonderful shadow characters, come in to move it on. And now we have Psyche, who, by the way, doesn't use the knife, right? She uses only the lamp. She really wants to see. And sees the God in him, which would be tricky for Eros, wouldn't it? Because after all, he might be called upon to live up to that. He's no longer just the husband who remains invisible. But the tranquility of that scene that she had is gone. And she's going to have to, there's this energy of her desperation. Something's going to have to happen and change. So, she's lonely, she's miserable, she's now left in the ordinary, just regular ground. And so, she wants to drown herself in the river. She wants to be done with this. She wants it to go away, huh? She collapses on the bank of the river. She sits very quietly. Her collapse, in a way, is kind of necessary. Something has to kind of restore her there. And Pan appears with Echo in his lap. You know, Pan, the god of, you know, being beside yourself, a wild, out of control. I didn't realize the word panic comes from Pan. Wildly beside yourself. And Pan says, you must pray to the god of love. Well, we know who that is. And so she has to find him. But she can't find him without going to Aphrodite, because he's with Mom. But she tries all the other goddesses first. It's like, oh no, please don't say I have to do this. So she goes to all the other goddesses' temples, and they all say, nah. So she ends up going to Aphrodite, who really reams her, humiliates her, rages at her, says, you can be, I guess, you can be a scullery maid. But this is what you gotta do. So, the tasks, yeah? Her suffering. And if we look at it in terms, sort of interjecting a little bit here, you know, in our journey, you know, there is that moment when we recognize our misery and our alienation and we ask, what do I have to do? What do I do? So Aphrodite gives her the, this is what you do. Task number one, huge pile of seeds. You got to sort them all out before nightfall or you die. While Aphrodite goes off to a wedding festival. The irony of it all. And so she weeps. She decides on suicide because it's hopeless. But here comes the army of ants. So ants, you know, who are of the earth. And you know that humiliate is related to humus, right? Aphrodite brings her down to earth, and the ants come to rescue her. And they create order. Yeah. Out of this chaos of this great pile, they make piles. And so, you know, she's left the place where the culture would tell her what to do, right? This is what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to marry one of the neighboring kings and, you know, do the laundry on Mondays and the ironing on Tuesdays. But now she's finding this, being helped by ant nature. Just do this quiet thing. And that one reminded me of Yu, the limping god, in China, who tamed the river. You know, there was no agriculture possible because the river had no banks. It was always going everywhere. But it took Yu, the limping god, to bring the river into its banks so that there could be agriculture and the people could be fed. So you see the connection. The ants are creating some order there for her. A protection from the too muchness of the seeds, food, yeah. So she succeeds, she does a task. Aphrodite is disgusted, but gives it the next job. Next job, you need to go gather the golden fleece from the rams in the field across the river. You do it by midnight or you die. So she heads down to the river to throw herself in because these rams are known as being deadly, deadly fierce. And she gets right down there at the borderland, right? Right down there at the border of earth and water by the river. And the reeds, those plants of the border, tell her, wait until dusk, which is its own kind of borderland, isn't it? Wait until dusk, and you'll be able to gather enough fleece from the reeds and the branches. They won't even see you. So, the rams, in case you ever needed a clearer symbol of masculine power and what scares girls, with that great intrinsic power, she doesn't get greedy. She goes down, she follows the advice of the reeds by the river, and she takes just as much as she'll need to satisfy Aphrodite, just enough. And she goes back, and Aphrodite's even more pissed off. Furious. So now she says, okay, here's your next job. You need to fill a crystal goblet with water from the Styx. It's a circular stream. It flows from the high mountain to hell and back. So the waters of life and death, yeah? The circular stream of death and life, life and death. And is guarded by monsters, by the way. So she gets down to the river and collapses. And the eagle, sent by Zeus, who's kind of interested here and willing to protect his son's interests, Eros is his son, yeah? The eagle of Zeus, who can get some perspective, yeah? Who can get has a very wide view, comes down, fills the goblet for her. So her sort of unfocused consciousness, her despair, in her despair, she cannot see a way. There's no focus. To dip that goblet in there, you have to be able to focus on a single point. It takes the eagle to bring that vastness into a human life, one goblet at a time. So she succeeds again, and finally, Aphrodite says, I really got to get rid of this girl. So she sends her to the underworld. To ask Persephone for a cask of her beauty ointment. So most impossible of all. So Psyche goes and finds a high tower to jump off of and kill herself. But the tower gives her instructions, very detailed, specific instructions about what she must and must not do. Go to a hidden place. Find there the breathing place of Hades, opening out into a pathless way. And I'm going to read this section from Robert Johnson because I think he says this part so well. So she's instructed to go to the underworld and ask Persephone, goddess of the underworld, the most hidden, the eternal maiden, queen of mysteries. So the instructions from the tower, to go to the hidden place, as I said, and then she is to carry with her two pieces of barley cake in her hands, two coins in her teeth, and get tough, get ready, because this is not going to be easy. So she finds her way to the pathless path, descends to the river Styx, and finds a lame man driving a lame donkey laden with sticks of wood. Some of the sticks fall to the ground, and Psyche starts to reach down to help, yeah, to pick up the sticks for the lame man. But she remembers she can't. She's forbidden to do that because it would exhaust her energies. And she needs all of her energies for this task, for going down, down, down all the way. Then she comes to the ferryman, Charon, with his patched boat. She gives him the coin for the passage. But while they are crossing the river, a drowning man begs for her help, reaching up pitifully, and she has to say no. You're going to face the goddess of the underworld. You got nothing to spare. So now she's down there. She walks towards her goal, and there are three old women weaving the strands of fate on a loom. They ask Psyche to help, but she's got to walk right on by. That's a temptation, yeah? You can help weave fate. But no. And so because they would have eaten one of her barley cakes, and she needs it. So you cannot feed the ladies of fate. So now she's got the guardian of Hades, that dog, that giant dog with three heads, right? Cerberus. She throws one of the barley cakes, and the three heads are fighting over it, so she's able to sneak by. Finally, she's in the hall of Persephone. And the important thing here is there are all kinds of goodies to eat. Persephone would like her to join her in feasting, and she must say no and not sit on the throne that's offered her. She has to sit on the ground and eat only a crust of bread. Because there's an old law that would bind you to any house where you've taken hospitality. And if she accepts that hospitality, she will be there forever. She's getting a little bit tougher now. She passes all of those tests. She asks Persephone for the cask of beauty ointment. And Persephone just gives it to her. And so now it's time for Psyche to go back up, 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 up into the light. She retraces all her steps. She still has what she needs. And the last instruction, though, that the tower gave was, don't open the box. And don't ask what's in there. So there she is, within sight. She can see the light. She can see the human world. And she thinks, you know, I would be foolish not to take a look in there. I would be so beautiful for my lover who's waiting for me. And so she opens it up, and there's nothing in there, apparently. No thing. And that no thing comes forth, and she falls into a deadly sleep. And she's just lying there like a corpse. Meanwhile, though, Eros has been healing up gradually at Mom's place. And he hears her distress. And because all the doors had been locked, but apparently the windows were open. So he flies to her, wipes the sleep from her face, puts it back in the cask, and wakes her with a prick of one of his arrows. Seems to be his thing, those arrows. And gives her a talking to. And she succeeds. That's her final task. She completes it. And meanwhile, while she's going off to take that back to Aphrodite, Eros goes up to Dad and says, I need a little help here, Zeus. And Zeus gives him some grief for his bad behavior, but says, yeah, but you're my son. Okay, I'll help. Calls all the gods together, tells Hermes to bring Psyche up there, announces to all of them that, you know, aren't we really sick of Eros, this wild kid who's always making trouble? Wouldn't it be good if he got married and settled down? So they all agree. And so Zeus says, all right, we're going to have a wedding. And but they need a ceremony in which Zeus gives Psyche a pot of immortality and tells her to drink from it. And with that comes the promise that Eros will not leave her again. And then there's the great party. And in due time, Psyche bears a daughter whose name is Pleasure. And in some accounts, actually, that word is charis, which is joy. And it's the root of, it's what became Christ, and it's the root of charisma. And that's the baby that gets born at the end of this story. So maybe we better walk a little bit, and then we have time to sit some more.